like to make love with you, 'cause you are a woman and I am one too, and you are my sister, my lover, my friend. I'll be there when the day tries to end. I carefully would leave you laying, but I feel a weeping and wailing. I'd like to make love with you. I'd like to make love with you, not to you or at you, as men often do, to kiss you deeper if only one time, to sing a song without any rhyme. And if I make love never again, somehow we'll be closer friends. I'd like to make love with you.
I'm Randy Alford, and this is The Gay Life on KSAN for June 17th and 19th, 1979. You've been listening to the music of Teresa Troll from her Olivia Records album, The Ways a Woman Can Be. We'll hear more of Teresa's music later in the show and also talk with her about her music and her life. Beginning with this show, KSAN San Francisco presents The Gay Life every other week in this time slot. This represents a significant commitment by KSAN to provide programming for the gay and lesbian communities of the Bay Area and Northern California. Also next Sunday, June 24th, KSAN will present live spot reports from the Gay Freedom Day Parade and Celebration, beginning at approximately 11 a.m. and lasting until 3 p.m. This will be the second year the Live 95 has been live at Gay Freedom Day. Starting in July, the fortnightly Gay Life we'll present regular news and commentary, in addition to our interviews and features. On this show, we'll talk to Teresa Troll and to Jim Spada, author of The Spada Report, a fascinating volume of over 1,000 gay men talking about sex, love, relationships, and life. And we'll also give you some announcements about Gay Pride Week and Gay Freedom Day. But first, a talk with the lawyers involved in the landmark civil rights case, Gay Law Students versus Pacific Telephone. On Wednesday, June 6th, we visited the Castro Street offices of gay rights advocates and recorded this conversation. Dick Geyer, you originally brought the suit. What does the Supreme Court decision in Gay Law Students versus Pacific Telephone mean?
It means many things, but basically it gives employment discrimination protection for gay people against the Pacific Telephone Company, because the Supreme Court found that Pacific Telephone was a tremendous monopoly, pervasively regulated by the state, and therefore could not arbitrarily discriminate in any of its employment decisions. It could not deny equal protection to employees or applicants for employment. Perhaps more significantly, the court decided that the political activities provisions of the Labor Code protected anybody, any employer applicant of any private employer, who would affirmatively disclose his or her sexual orientation from employment discrimination. This can be a very far-reaching decision for the future, because it applies to all employers in the state of California of any size or type.
David Moon and Lois Salisbury from Public Advocates Incorporated, at the time that the case was argued, Lois was a public advocate, David was on loan from the district attorney's office, having started the case with the Chinatown North Beach Neighborhood Legal Assistance Foundation. You argued the case before the Supreme Court in what was now 21 months ago. Do you have any additions or comments in terms of what you think the case means?
Well, there are a couple of other things that are, I think, important about the case, and they're important not only for gay rights but for other minorities in the state. One of the major things that's important is that the court talked about arbitrary discrimination. So when gays are discriminated against, or anyone else for that matter, arbitrarily, the case will apply in an employment context. Now, in other contexts, the phrase arbitrary discrimination is well defined. It means something that's unrelated to a particular occupational requirements. Long hair, for instance, may very well be an arbitrary kind of determination. Any kind of blanket discrimination which does not relate to the particular job or the particular individual is to be considered arbitrary discrimination. A second factor is the expansion of the concept of state action. They considered the Pacific Telephone Company, in this case, an arm of the government. And that's an expanded concept of this role, and it brings in the constitutional protections of equal protection and due process, which may apply to many other kinds of organizations heretofore thought of as private businesses. And a third aspect, which I think is very important, is that the court reserved a possible decision on what we call the Marinship Doctrine. And that's a doctrine which is a common law concept that grew out of the 1940 Second World War period, 1940s, which basically says that arbitrary discrimination by any employer may be illegal. And that may be a case which we'll hear about in the years to come, a doctrine which may be applied in other circumstances.
So you see it as the opening of a much larger area, but not necessarily having gone very far in that direction?
I think the court has said to private employers who may not be affected by the labor code, although Dick and I probably can't think of anybody right now, or public utilities, people beyond the reach of this particular case, take heed, we may be willing to go even further than this, and that no one should discriminate on any arbitrary basis in California in employment.
Lois, do you see anything else in the court's decision?
Yes, but on a broader level, I think that the court decision signals to two very important constituencies that the California court is still willing to take an aggressive attitude towards protecting individual rights. They signal that to the California legislature, who has failed to act aggressively in this area, and I'm happy to say that the California Supreme Court did aggressively take responsibility for state conduct in this area and for interpreting state legislation in many ways in a very broad fashion. They did not go as far as we would have wished, but they went a very far way, and I think the legislature is left out hanging by themselves and wondering where they have gone wrong in not assuming full responsibility to protect gays in all aspects as they have gone to do for other minority groups. I also think it signals to the federal court system and to other state court systems that once again the California judiciary is willing to be very protective and very careful in its interpretation of our equal protection clause, recognizing that an equal protection clause that isn't flexible and isn't in tune with the modern day manifestations of violations of rights is a dead instrument. And I take great heart in the California Supreme Court once again finding meaning in the California Equal Protection Clause in a way that I think reflects true needs of people who in fact are having their rights violated. I represented in the amicus proceeding as friends of the court a variety of minority groups, including women's groups, blacks, Chinese, the handicapped, who came forward and said, we wish to see gays protected because we feel that when any group is suffering from this kind of discrimination, it threatens all of us. And I was very gratified to see the California Supreme Court recognize that principle and be solid in their support of the expansive meaning that equal protection has to have in contemporary society.
On the same day that this decision, which was a narrow 4-3 decision, was handed down, the Ninth Circuit Court ruled opposite in a parallel federal case. What do you think that portends?
It didn't rule opposite. It really agreed with the California Supreme Court as to a statutory protection via ordinary employment discrimination law as being inapplicable to gay people. Title VII of the Federal Civil Rights Act doesn't mention sexual orientation, therefore gay people aren't protected. The California Fair Employment Practice Act similarly doesn't mention sexual orientation, therefore gay people aren't protected. There are no conflict in the two opinions. The federal court did say that gay people did not constitute any kind of protected class under federal law. That was sort of, we think, insulting, but the opinions are not conflicting. The California Supreme Court utilized the duties of a monopoly on the part of Pacific Telephone to give gay people some protection against employment discrimination, and as we said before, it used the political activities and associations provisions of the labor code to give gay people protection against general employment discrimination. Those things were not before the federal court at all.
Can Pacific Telephone appeal this decision?
They could try, I suppose, but in fact there are really no grounds for them to appeal. The case is squarely based in California law, both statutory interpretation and California constitutional doctrine, and for them to go to the U.S. Supreme Court would be a pretty empty gesture.
At the same time, the decision does not mean that Pacific Telephone has discriminated against gay people, merely that gay people can sue them alleging the discrimination. Is that correct?
That's basically correct. We allege certain things, and the court had to accept them as true for purposes of this particular hearing. However, I think there's pretty strong evidence, which will be shown at the trial, that there has been discrimination in the past.
So now the case goes back to the trial level in Superior Court to determine whether or not there has, in fact, been discrimination.
Exactly.
What about the timing of the decision? Does anyone know why it took 21 months for the court to make a decision?
We can only guess. There were lots of aspects of the case which were very complicated. It dealt with three or four different statutory interpretations and several constitutional doctrines. It was a 4-3 decision. There are subtleties in it not worth necessarily going into, which suggests that achieving that majority required some delicate compromises and some careful wording, and I'm sure that took time. Whether or not the court, on top of that, sat on the decision for any particular reason is really beyond any of our knowledge other than just wondering why it took so long ourselves. But there's lots of work represented in that opinion, and it certainly is a very carefully worded and presented opinion, and that speaks for itself.
And David, you were about to say
something.
Well,
I was just going to say that there are over 70 pages of written material there, which is a rather lengthy opinion. More than that, I think it does represent, if anyone has had any inclination to feel the Supreme Court might be hiding from the recent critiques of the Supreme Court, does represent a very strong statement by that body, which I was gratified to see, that they are not going to cower up in the Supreme Court chambers from their critics, be they political critics or critics of any stripe. And I think the criticism for the length of time that it took is probably not very appropriate in light of the courageous steps that the four majority members took.
It was encouraging that Justice Tobriner analogized the struggle for gay rights with the struggle for black rights and women's rights. Usually, courts distinguish gay people from other established minorities.
Does Tobriner's logic about coming out as a political action, because it's been called upon to be a political action, does it establish in California a constitutional right to come out of the closet?
It's a statutory right. The labor code is a statute passed by legislature. It says an employer should not discriminate based on political activities.
I'd like to think you already had a constitutional right to do so in California under the First Amendment, not only in California but nationally. What this was dealing with was specifically the question of coming out in the context of your workplace. And I think that the realistic recognition by Tobriner was, again, another part of the opinion that we were all very appreciative of, because it showed he was in touch with the real world and real pressures and wasn't off in an ivory tower, not recognizing exactly what the pressures are upon people and exactly the kinds of consequences and misery an employer or anyone can impose upon a person in putting them in that double bind of feeling that they're going to be penalized if they in any way acknowledge some significant aspect of their personality.
Do any of you have any comments on whether or not this decision will restore faith in the gay, among the gay community in the court system following only 10 days after the Dan White verdict, which probably caused a low ebb in gay opinions of the courts?
Well, I think they're not really comparable. We're talking about a criminal situation involving the assassination of politicians decided by a jury of lay people.
But still, it's a question of confidence in the courts as a general sense. And we're sitting here with three lawyers and a reporter who's done a lot of legal reporting before. But in the general population, the courts are kind of perceived as an overall system.
And Dan White is just one person. This opinion, as I see it, is the first high court opinion that gives gay peoples any rights against discrimination by private employers as opposed to government employers. And that's what's significant. It's a much bigger thing than the trial of one person for assassinating two politicians.
David?
Well, I agree with Dick on that. It's difficult. You know, since the Supreme Court is a policy, in a sense, a policy-making kind of an organization, to equate that with one criminal trial, which involved 12 jurors who are non-lawyers and who may or may not have judged the evidence based on emotion or objectivity. That's not really the point here. The point is that what's going to happen down the line here for gay people in California, I think, is it's a much brighter world. In terms of any legal difficulties they may have or employment hassles. I think as long as one is forced out of the economic system by employment discrimination, one has no political power. If you don't have the money, you ain't got the power. And by the gay community getting into more and more political power via this kind of a move, I think that their problems in the political arena are probably going to diminish. I certainly hope so.
Lois, any closing comments?
I would simply answer your question more broadly, which is that I believe that all minority groups are suffering from continuing erosion of their belief that the judicial system is going to be the salvation or their great protector. The Bakke decision, even emanating from the same court, has certainly greatly eroded the confidence or the belief that the judicial system is where our ultimate protection is going to be. To the degree that this system helps rebuild any confidence or and is more than just an erratic one-time good shot in the proper direction, I think all of us are going to be heartened. And that's certainly what I meant by my opening comment. I feel revitalized, and I think the kinds of clients that I traditionally represent are going to feel somewhat heartened to see the California court take a strong stand on a very key issue that has ramifications for any discriminated group.
Okay, thank you, Lois Salisbury, David Moon, and Dick Geyer.
My family claims the right to know what's wrong with me. They say I'm not turning out the way they meant me to be. My mother's given up my marriage. My father's given up his son. The Holy One is way a woman loving women when it's said and done. Soon they'll see that we're a woman loving women, and that's all we'll be. At home or at work, they'll try to put you down. They can't seem to understand how you survive with no loving man around. Well, listen, people, and I'll tell you this. Loving a woman ain't one stroke short of bliss. And we're a woman loving women when it's said and done. Cause we're woman loving women. Sing it loud and long. Yeah, we're sisters united in a love that's oh so strong.
people think Sappho was a little touched. I just think Sappho loved that touch we all love so much. And well, woman, loving women, I'm all too much. Cause well,
woman, loving women, singing loud and long. Yes, we're sisters united in a love that's oh so strong. Some say I'm crazy, it's an Amazon face. But soon they'll see.
Our next guest on The Gay Life is Teresa Troll, whose music we've been listening to short portions this morning. Good morning, Teresa.
Good morning.
Your music is very interesting. It's much more lesbian identified than almost all music, and even than most of what is generally called women's music.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess that's true. It reflects a great deal of my life, which lesbianism has a great deal to do with.
Now, the music we've been hearing is from your album, The Ways a Woman Can Be, which is now over 2 years old and has music that goes back a long way. How long ago did you start writing some of these songs?
Well, a lot of the songs on the album I wrote between, say, 17 and 19. So they really actually reflect a pretty old era in my music. I've recently been branching out and doing a sort of almost returning to the music I was doing before I was performing solo, which is a lot of gospel-influenced and kind of Southern roots music.
But we'll still...
You'll still hear some cuts from the album, that's for sure.
And there'll be strong feminist consciousness still remains, although you've gone back to earlier musical roots.
Mm-hmm. It's more or less a musical style that I'm reverting to, not so much a concept in lyrics or anything.
How do you think music fits into the woman's struggle?
Oh, it's totally historical. I mean, music always has been a very solid reflection of a culture. And so of women's culture, I think nothing speaks to it better than women's music. The only thing is that there's been women's music for hundreds and hundreds of years. It's just now that we're starting to define it. Because anytime there's been music that has really reflected an honest version of women's lives, I think you can consider it women's music.
You were recorded on Olivia Records, through whose cooperation and courtesy you're here today, and we're playing your music. What problems does Olivia have, or what problems are there in general in the distribution and production of women's music? Is there resistance in the music industry?
Well, there's resistance, and it's hard to say how much of it is politics and how much of it is financial because of, you know, the incredible industry that the music industry is. We're also trying to build our own distribution network. We have about 100 women internationally that distribute our albums in order to try and get that financial cut towards women and to build kind of an economic base. And it's been very, very hard to make the albums real accessible. I mean, ideally, we'd like to see them at Sears and Woolworth and in 10 and 15 cent racks, although they don't have those anymore.
There's also a tendency in women's music, for instance, labels like Olivia and Redwood and so forth, for other women musicians to be coming on and doing backups and people who are stars of their own albums taking care of and assisting other women in backup roles on the albums. And it's also something that's even permeated the big names and so forth, so that, for instance, Linda Ronstadt and Emmylou Harris and Maria Muldaur keep on appearing on each other's albums. And it seems to be very rare among male vocalists to be doing that kind of thing.
Well, it happens a lot with vocalists and with instrumentalists, with women, I think, because of the lack of opportunities in the field, there are not that many women musicians on a professional level, you know, so there tends to be a lot of interplay and a lot of interchange, and hopefully that will continue as the number of women grows. But it's true, there's a lot smaller numbers of women musicians who are actively working and performing.
Your new stuff, when people will get a chance to hear that on Gay Freedom Day, I understand, you're going to
both on the 17th and the 24th in the East Bay and in San Francisco.
Those of you who are listening to this show on Sunday We'll get a chance to hear Teresa this afternoon at East Bay Gay Day in Ho Chi Minh Park, as well as next Sunday, for those of you who are listening to the show on Monday night, at Gay Freedom Day in San Francisco Civic Center. We'll be saying more about both of those events later in the show. You also have a concert coming up.
It's July 14th at the Oakland Auditorium. I'll be doing that concert also with full band regalia,
and
so that should be fun.
What other artists will be appearing there with you?
Well, it's not definite right now, but the women who I know for sure will be performing for me will be Debbie Poirier on piano, Joy Jolks on bass, and Linda Tellery and Dee Dee Dickerson on vocals.
Who would you say is the single most important musical influence in your life, from going all the way back? You can pick anyone.
Easily Aretha Franklin. She's my idol of life. Yeah, I think she's an incredible, outrageous performer. And to me, there'll be no other vocalist like her ever.
Have you ever gotten a chance to meet her?
Not to meet her. I've had many a chance to see her. I'd love to meet her. But every time I've been to see her, it's been at places like Carnegie Hall.
Have you sent her your records?
No. No, I haven't.
Oh, you should do it with music like this. I'm sure she'd be impressed.
Or maybe I'll ask her to produce my next album.
Okay. Well, again, there'll be an opportunity for people to hear you at the two free gigs on East Bay Gay Day and on Gay Freedom Day, and at the July 14th Oakland Coliseum concert, Oakland Auditorium.
Oakland Auditorium Coliseum. We're not quite there yet.
And let's listen to a little bit more of your music. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you very
much.
Well, she's a hard-driving lover, soon to recover from all the tears and woes. Oh, she never was a shiver, but soon she'll discover that people mostly come and go, mostly go. And she knows I never want another lover like no other. As time goes on,
as time goes on,
I hope she'll see,
I hope she'll see,
I hope she'll see me. She's everybody's baby. She's about to drive me wild. Oh, child, she can say she's lost, but it's me who pays the cost. I think it's gonna cramp my style, gonna cramp my style, but I'll never want another.
This is The Gay Life on KSAM. And that was Teresa Troll's I Hope She'll See, from The Ways a Woman Can Love on Olivia Records. The cut before the interview with Teresa was Women Loving Women from the same album. Gay Pride Week begins on Sunday, June 17th. Here are some of the events leading up to Gay Freedom Day on June 24th. Get out your pen and paper. We have lots of times, addresses, and other information that you may want to take down. Sunday, June 17th is East Bay Gay Day at Ho Chi Minh Park between Derby and Benvenue in Berkeley from noon to 6 p.m. There will be various bands and booths as part of the action. Also on June 17th is the Sacramento Gay Parade. This is Sacramento's first annual gay parade. It starts at noon at 14th and I Streets, and it's sponsored by The Way Station and Emperor IV Walter M. Coburn. On Tuesday, June 19th, psychiatrist Thomas Zaz speaks out on the Dan White verdict at 7:30 p.m. at the Mission High School Auditorium at Church and 18th Streets. Admission is free. Tuesday is also the day of the Dan White sentencing. On Wednesday, June 20th, Lesbian Masquerade, an informal history of lesbians in early San Francisco who passed as men. This is sponsored by the San Francisco Gay History Project at the Women's Building, 3543 18th Street, between Valencia and Guerrero at 8 o'clock with a $2 donation. On Friday, June 22nd, there's a concert with Mary Watkins and Linda Tillery, sponsored by the San Francisco Women's Centers and Black Women's Conference. This is also at the Women's Building. If you missed the address before, take it down again, or take it down now. 3543 18th Street, between Valencia and Guerrero. It starts at 7:30 p.m. for $4. Also on Friday, June 22nd, at the Women's Building at 7:30 in another room, is Masculinity and Militarism, a Northern California premiere of Between Men. Saturday, June 23rd, Gay Freedom Day rally, sponsored by the Lambda Association of Santa Clara, Incorporated, at St. James Park in San Jose. This is the San Jose Gay Freedom Day on the day before the San Francisco one. It starts at noon. It'll be informal fun, games, food and beverage booths sponsored by organizations and businesses and individuals of the entire South Bay area. The keynote address will be given by Assemblyman Art Agnos. In San Francisco on that afternoon, Saturday, June 23rd, the Gay Softball League presents a grandstand jamboree, the largest gay sports event in San Francisco history, at Kezar Stadium from 11 in the morning till 5 in the evening. Games feature the Gay Softball League All-Stars versus the Los Angeles Gay Softball League All-Stars and the San Francisco All-Stars versus the San Francisco Fire Department. That evening, Robin Tyler is in concert at the Women's Building of the Bay Area starting at 9 o'clock. Tickets are $5 in advance, $5.50 at the door. Once more, the Women's Building, at which there will be events all week, 3543 18th Street between Valencia and Guerrero. And as for the big day, Sunday, June 24th, we'll give you some information about that later in the show. Changing the subject now, our next guest is Jim Spada, a Los Angeles author who has just published The Spada Report, the newest survey of gay male sexuality and lifestyles. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning, Randy.
This book, I want to say for our readers, is a treasure trove of information that the statistics are kept to a bare minimum, and there's just a great amount of detailed responses by
1,038 men.
1,038 men from all over the country, from all walks of life, on coming out, on gay male sexuality, relationships, women, problems of being gay, and being gay in general. And it is just filled with information of people saying one thing about a subject followed by people saying exactly the opposite thing. For instance, how people feel about one-night stands or whether or not coming out to their parents produced a positive response or a negative response. How'd you get the idea for the book, Jim?
The genesis of it primarily was the Height Report, which, for those of you who haven't heard of it, was a landmark book about 3 years ago in which women were asked to fill out a questionnaire verbally and express themselves about their feelings about sex and their relationships with their husbands or their boyfriends. And it was the first time that women had been asked to speak for themselves about their sexuality and had not been told by a psychiatrist how they're supposed to feel rather than how they actually do feel. And I felt that the same problem was true with gay people. that most of the surveys that had been done in the past were done by psychiatrists studying their patients. And I don't think that psychiatric patients are a representative sampling of any group. And yet when there was any commonality at all found among these psychiatric patients, it was universalized and it was applied to all gay men or gay women. And I just felt that it was a totally wrong approach. So I wanted to go to the average gay man, average as compared to a psychiatric patient, from all over the country, not just from one city, and find out what they were thinking about their sexuality and their lifestyles and their role in society, their place in society. And I think that's what the book is at this point.
The Height Report was concerned primarily with sexuality, though. Doesn't this book go a little bit further than that?
Yes, it does. The Height Report was very clinical and dealt only with sexuality. Mine has a section called Gay Male Sexuality, but it also concerns relationships with lovers, family background, political questions, because I felt that gay men should not be defined purely by their sexuality. So I wanted to find out the entire lifestyle picture.
Right. But there is also a considerable amount of details asking people whether or not they use toys or drugs or pornography during sex, whether or not they're turned on by uniforms or leather. Is the size of a man's penis, including your own, important to you? But we also have questions like, do you think that there are reasons that you're gay? What are the reasons, and so forth? And
I tried to cover everything. There were 55 questions, honed down from 112 original questions. And what I did to break it down was to eliminate any questions that didn't relate to being gay as specifically as these do. But I wanted to ask as many questions as I could to get the entire picture. So I did ask many clinically sexual questions, but also the others.
And you said that psychiatric patients are not a representative group. Now, the 1,038 men who answered your survey are not necessarily statistically representative either, are they?
No, and I wouldn't want the statistics that are in the back of the book to be applied to all men. For instance, if 42% of the 1,038 men who answered my survey said yes to a question, I wouldn't want anyone to say 42% of all gay men feel this way, because I don't think that's true of my book. I don't think it's true of any survey. It's impossible, unless you talk to every gay man in the country, to do that. I included the statistics primarily because I think people enjoy them, and they're interesting, and they give you some idea of what the tone of the responses was. But I didn't want the book to be statistical. I want the responses, and I've included every response, every viewpoint that was expressed with any frequency at all. I've included it because I wanted the entire range of views to be covered. I wanted people to read all the different sides of a question and come to their own conclusions. And that's what I see the book as being, food for thought, primarily.
Right. I think that range is probably the most descriptive word about the whole book. It has a wide range of questions, and the responses in each case, whether or not they're 10% or 20% or whoever that said it, the range of responses in each case where people will say, well, I came out when I was 2, and people, on the other hand, say that, well, I came out when I was 29, or people who say that they can't stand one-night stands, and people who say, well, they're great.
There is a tremendous diversity. I think that perhaps the only thing a lot of these men have in common is that they're gay, and I think it breaks down the stereotype that we all think alike, do the same things, want the same things out of life, have the same occupations. It's just not true, and there's as much diversity in this book among the men as there would be among any sampling of 1,000 people anywhere.
One of the interesting things is on the possible reasons for being homosexual, you juxtapose two quotes of one who says it's because he was extremely close to his father and they always felt free about expressing affection for each other, and that's juxtaposed with a man who says it's because I hated my father and never identified with him.
Well, I did that purposely, obviously, because one of the most famous theories is the close-binding mother-distant-father theory, which to me is totally nonsensical. I mean, Irving Biber came up with it, who was a clinical psychologist, and he found that a majority of his psychiatric patients had this kind of a background, so he said, voila, you know, this is the answer to homosexuality. And just not true. I mean, most of the men in the survey said that they didn't think there was any reason they were gay. They were either born that way or who cared. But those people who thought there was a specific reason, some of them said it was because their father was distant and hateful, and some people said it was because their father was so loving they tried to recreate that relationship in their lover relationships later in life. So the reasons kind of break down, and I think that there are probably a million different reasons or none at all.
Well, what strikes me about these two reasons or the variation in reasons, if one needs reasons, one could ask, what are the reasons that one becomes heterosexual? But did you get any inkling that perhaps, assuming that these people have pinpointed what made them feel predisposed towards homosexuality or whatever, and that accepting their own explanations of their own experience, do you think that if there are maybe hundreds of different reasons for homosexuality in terms of cause, that those are in any way connected perhaps to the difference in homosexual styles, and that, for instance, the relationship pattern and the sexual likes and dislikes of someone who feels that his homosexuality is attempting to continue warm relationships with men maybe is different from the same patterns and styles for someone who feels that his homosexuality is coming from a different source? That is, are the various causes in any way related to the various styles?
I rather doubt it. I think that, for instance, if a gay man is inclined toward monogamous relationships and very much wants to settle down with one person and not go from one person to the next, I have a feeling that that same person, had he developed heterosexually, would be that way as a heterosexual. He would not be a swinging single. He would be a married man who loved his family and wanted to be in the relationship. So I think that the kind of gay person you are has as much to do with your personality development as anyone else. You know, the kind of person you are doesn't necessarily have anything to do with your sexuality. I could be wrong in that, but I tend to think not. I think that your personality development is not necessarily tied into your sexual orientation. Although, for instance, if you're a young person and you're gay and you feel like you're an outcast, that has a profound effect on your personality. You become shy or insecure or whatever, or arrogant. Whatever your reaction to being a social misfit is, affects your later personality. So in that case, the homosexuality may be a strong determinant in the development of your personality. But I don't know if there's a correlation between why you feel you're gay and what your personality is. I think they're probably separate.
You spent 2.5 years on this project. What was your biggest surprise in terms of the results?
Generally speaking, I think it was the level of commitment of these people in terms of changing things, not only on a personal level to make life better for themselves, but on a general level to create a better climate for sexual understanding and the acceptance of all kinds of sexual and other differences among people. I found that very, not surprising, but rewarding, because I felt that these people were very selfless in their goal of a better understanding between opposing factions. Specifically, I was somewhat surprised by the youth of the people who, when they discovered they were gay, when they had their first feelings of being gay, 42% of them said it was before the age of 9, which seems to me a very interesting statistic, especially in light of Anita Bryant's theories about recruitment and choice. Another thing that surprised me was that more than half the men told their parents or have come out to their family. Twice as many of those men received good reactions as received bad reactions. And I think that's a very encouraging statistic and somewhat surprising. The most negative surprise I had was the reaction to the question, what are your feelings about lesbianism? Because 25% of the men were opposed to it. And I found it rather unfathomable that any gay man who's asking for a release of oppression and an end to discrimination would, you know, feel that way about lesbianism. Many of the men stated that they felt very guilty about that, and they felt that they were a victim of their male upbringing, and they were trying to fight it. And I think that's a very interesting psychological phenomenon, that you can try to throw off the shackles of oppression and prejudice for yourself, but still apply it to another group.
That's for surprises. Did you have any pet theories confirmed by the results?
Pet theories?
Yeah, did you make any predictions ahead of time, even to yourself, about the results that
I didn't. I didn't. If I had one hope, it was that the negative stereotypes because one of the reasons for doing the book at this time was as a reaction to Anita Bryant and all of her negative rhetoric. I was hoping that the negative stereotypes would be dispelled, and I think in all cases they were. There was a segment within every question that said yes, for instance, to kinky sex or public sex or whatever the stereotype had been. There was an element, and it's expressed in the book, but for instance, 70% of the men said they were not into any kind of kinky sex, and around that said that they had never been involved in any kind of public sexual activity. And I'm not making any judgments about either of those, but what I'm saying is that the homophobes would have it that that's all we do is screw on every street corner or behind every bush, and all we are into is S&M and B&D and humiliation and brutality. And it just is not borne out by the results of the book. Right.
You are, and I will commend you for this, remarkably non-judgmental. The section on Do You Enjoy One Night Stands begins, "A high level of sexual availability is a major component of most gay men's lives." Why did you choose that non-judgmental term instead of promiscuity?
Well, there's a footnote, which is probably why you're asking me the question, and I said that I chose that because the dictionary definition of promiscuity, let me read it because I don't forget the exact words. An indiscriminate and random choice of partners. And I thought especially indiscriminate was just not correct. If being promiscuous is being random and indiscriminate, then gay men are not promiscuous, because I don't think there's indiscriminate choice of sexual partners in the gay world. I think it's quite discriminate in terms of attraction and type and thinking the person would be a good sexual partner to have.
Do you ask any questions about type?
I did. One of the questions was, please describe your ideal man. But I didn't use the answers, because as interesting as they were, I didn't feel they were that relevant to the whole social issue of homosexuality. It was kind of the same answers I would have gotten from any other kind of survey. But to get back to your original question, I used availability because I just felt that promiscuity was not the right word. And I tried to be non-judgmental. I hope that none of my personal views about anything come through in the book, although it is very positive about certain aspects of gay life. That's clear enough. But I don't make any judgments about kinky sex. I don't make any judgments about transvesticism. Nothing like that, because I don't think it's my place
to. About having relationships as opposed to having one-night stands and so forth. It is. Oh, yeah. It's a very tone-neutral book throughout. The name of it, again, is The Spader Report, The Newest Survey of Gay Male Sexuality, and it's published by Signet, and it's got over 300 pages of just wide varieties of responses. And I want to emphasize again for our listeners that the bulk of the book consists of written out paragraph and longer responses that people wrote to a survey that was not a multiple choice or yes-no, true-false survey. It's people expressing themselves about their sexuality. It's what makes it remarkable. It's 300 pages of what we've given you only the thinnest taste of this morning. And I hope that people will pick it up, look through it, share it with friends. It's great reading. You don't have to read it all the way through. You can just kind of pick out the question you want to answer, you want to see how other people are thinking about, and read that. Or you can read it all the way through. It works either way. The Spader Report. Thank you for being with us this morning, Jim Spada.
Thank you, Randy.
Sunday, June 24th, is San Francisco's 9th annual Gay Freedom Day, and KSAN will be there live. The parade begins at 11 o'clock at Market and Spear Streets. Now, if you're in a group, remember that your group may be rendezvousing earlier at a slightly different location in that neighborhood, so check with your group. Featured in this year's parades are two gay marching bands, our own San Francisco Gay Freedom Day Marching Band and Twirling Corps, and Los Angeles's Great American Yankee Band. That spells out GAY band, of course. Floats and other marching contingents, plus new banners along Market Street, will add to the festivities. Booths offering food, fun, games, and organizations will be located in Civic Center Plaza. There will be entertainment and speakers beginning approximately at 1:30 in the Civic Center Plaza. The Gay Freedom Day Committee still needs lots of volunteer help. You can call 641-0100 for details. That's 641-0100. The Gay Freedom Day Committee. And after that, there are still more parties. There's an open-air tea dance at the Galleria Design Center, $7 in advance, $10 at the door. There's a tea dance at the Trocadero, $3 for members, non-members $5 at the door, and there's a women's dance with Chevert at the Women's Building, 3543 18th Street between Valencia and Guerrero, for $3. I want to refer all of you to the Gay Freedom Day Parade and Celebration official 1979 program. It contains most all of the information we've given you about the Gay Freedom Day this year, plus lots more, including the special Muni service that will be able to take you to the Gay Freedom Day Parade and Celebration next week. The program's being distributed all over the city in places where gay men and lesbians gather. You can also obtain a copy by phoning 641-0100. That's the Gay Freedom Day Committee. They can also provide you with details on all of these events or tell you who to contact for details. The Gay Life is now on every 2 weeks, and we're going to call it a fortnightly, which is a fancy word for every 2 weeks, because if we said biweekly, you wouldn't know if we meant that it's twice a week or every 2 weeks. And you also might think that we're making some bad jokes about gay, straight, or biweekly. The Gay Life for Sunday, June 17th, will be repeated on late Monday night at 1 a.m. That's really Tuesday, June 19th. Our guests on this edition of The Gay Life have been attorneys Dick Geyer, David Moon, and Lois Salisbury, author Jim Spada, and singer Teresa Troll. The Gay Life is co-produced by Fred Green and Randy Alfred, and I'm Randy Alfred. You can also read my regular column, On the Left, in every issue of the San Francisco Sentinel. The next edition of The Gay Life on KSAN San Francisco will be on July 1st and 3rd. But remember, join us next Sunday, June 24th, to celebrate Gay Freedom Day. KSAN will provide live spot coverage of the parade and the celebration from 11 a.m. until 4 p.m. That's KSAN, the Live 95, live at Gay Freedom Day. So come on out for Gay Freedom Day. Our time has come. Let's make the world safe for diversity.
It was a great